Your Honor, Jim Haley for Appellant James Allen. Your Honors, very briefly about the facts of the matter for the court. It was the state's theory in this criminal case that Mr. Allen was an accomplice to a series of robberies and burglaries that occurred that in Newcastle County. Mr. Allen, my client, was linked to Mr. Howard and McCray at trial by Mr. Howard, a co-defendant who testified, who had pled previously, and also by surveillance that police had conducted over a period of time, which showed that Mr. Allen had some frequency in the vicinity of a Walmart where the final attempted robbery occurred. Allen did testify also. He admitted his association with Howard and McCray, but he denied criminality. There was no dispute that three armed robberies, attempted burglaries, had occurred. Question was Allen an accomplice to those activities? Defense goal at trial, the main goal at trial was to defend that question. The first argument raised in opening brief was that the trial judge failed to give a Section 274 instruction. And as I've quoted, that section directs the jury, when considering accomplice liability, to measure, to weigh the individualized culpability of that alleged accomplice. And
they're meant by mental state, right?
By mental state, or the statute reads, Your Honor, as to any aggravating fact which he's alleged to have been accomplice to. Aggravating fact in this case was that robberies and attempted burglaries and so forth were accomplished by the use of a firearm. And that aggravated, I'll call a simple robbery or simple burglary, unarmed, into a higher degree felony, which the legislature has prescribed by making more felonious. And I've thought about this, asked the court to think about this in this very brief scenario. Let's imagine three scenarios and chauffeurs, let's say. The first fella is a taxi driver for somebody who's going to go to rob a bank. All he does is pick up a fare, take the bank robber to the bank. Banker goes in and does his business, asks the taxi driver to wait for him, comes out, taxi driver leaves, gets his fare, his $20, and that's it. Well, I think if that's all there were, fact-wise, that taxi driver is not an accomplice to the bank robbery, assuming he has nothing further done than just, you pick me up and go into the bank, and that's it. Scenario two is bank robber knows the taxi driver and says, I'm going to go rob that bank, take me to the bank. Taxi driver does not know that the bank robber has a gun with him. In fact, bank robber doesn't tell taxi driver he has a gun because taxi driver faints when he hears about guns. He doesn't want his taxi driver fainting on the way to the bank driving him. So that taxi driver knowledge is compartmentalized. Third taxi driver, ask him, well, how are you going to rob a bank? And robber says, well, I got this gun on my waistband. 274 says that third taxi driver is more culpable than the second taxi driver because he has some complicity, some knowledge of the aggravating fact of a firearm that taxi driver 2 did not have. And well, he knows this is more felonious.
Wait a second.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm confused here. Robbery always involves intent, right?
True.
Okay. So you're saying that if party number 1 intends to commit a robbery, but doesn't know that party number 2 has a weapon, then party number 1 cannot be found guilty of armed robbery?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that the jury has to be instructed on what is party number 1's complicity in that. Now, if party number 1 should have known, perhaps, it can be argued that they've been doing these robberies for years, and he always knows that party number 2 had a gun.
You're saying that in order for somebody who is a participant in the robbery,
yes, Your Honor,
to be charged with armed robbery, that participant has to know that somebody else has a gun.
Not so much charged as convicted. That party number is going to be charged no matter what, obviously. But as far as lesser included offenses and 274 instruction at trial, saying think about the aggravating facts here and accomplice's liability for aggravating facts.
Well, tell us in this case why, in the existence or non-existence, knowledge, lack of knowledge of a gun, was in the case.
Your Honor, It was in the case essentially as a controversy between Mr. Allen's testimony and Mr. Howard's testimony. Howard testified that he and McRae were the perpetrators in effect of on the scene of these three events, and that McRae had a gun.
Allen presented an alibi, correct?
He testified to his frequency at a certain location that was suspicious, saying that he was there visiting other women at that time, and he was also not there himself when the robberies were being done. He was not a part of those events.
Well, my question is, what was the disputed fact about there being a gun? It would be one thing if we go back to your taxi cab scenario. Allen had testified and said, I didn't know he had a gun. Now, clearly, you know, he could say he was there and he wasn't even aware of the robbery, but moreover, he didn't know there was a gun and may or may not have incriminated himself. Or someone else could have said Allen didn't know there was a gun. But when your defense is non-participation, it seems that you would have to show there was at least a dispute in somebody's mind that a gun was or a weapon was or was not used.
I would submit, Your Honor, that we did not need to, Allen said he wasn't there. Obviously, he knew nothing of the events that had transpired as far as robberies and so forth had gone. And Mr. Howard testified that he and McRae did the events and McRae had the gun. I would submit that no matter what, the way I read the statute, Your Honors, is when a 271 instruction is appropriate for accomplice liability, 274 is be given essentially in partnership with 271, so that no matter what, the jury makes an individualized judgment about how much did this accomplice sign up for in this whole conspiracy or transaction, et cetera. And so beyond the bald dispute Your Honor referred to, that essentially summarizes it, Your Honor, but that nevertheless, the jury has to be instructed on that and has to decide whether Allen was some kind of remote accomplice or was he some, you know, more a main accomplice who can be held liable for all the aggravating facts of the transaction. So it's more of a, I would submit, Your Honor, a legal requirement, Your Honor, when
274 must always be added to a 271 instruction?
When there's a, when the charges to which you're accomplice to can be divided into lower mental states, Your Honor, the court's always said yes to that. But it also says in the plain language of the statute, Your Honor,
what about the charges in this case?
In this case, when there are aggravating facts which can distinguish offenses, it says in 274, plain language, the jury shall be instructed to assess the accomplice's liability for those aggravating facts, Your Honor. So I would submit, yes, when a case, when charges can be distinguished by aggravators, the jury is to decide the accomplice's liability, culpability for that aggravator also, Your Honor. That's my reading of them working together as legal matters, not so much.
And is that your position on that is only for the weapons offense?
It would be for the aggravator that I point to as any offense involving use of a gun, Your Honor. So that means simple burglary went to armed burglary, higher degree or lower, and then all the robberies went from simple robbery to armed robbery. So any of the offenses involving weapons, yes, Your Honor, I would submit that that's an aggravator, since there are lesser offenses of the same sort not involving a gun. And the one case where this court seemed to cite that principle with approval, plain language of the statute, was Herring versus State. And the court said that, approved of a robbery being given, charge that is, not just armed robbery, but said we couldn't go to theft because there was no dispute about a theft occurring. But the only dispute was about
it. Well, as the state points out, Coleman and another subsequent case seem to go the other way.
They do. And I thought about, well, is there a reconciliation of those things? And I believe they've, the extent that Coleman and those other following cases that the state referred to ignore the clause or the phrase of the statute which refers to, you know, the accomplice's liability or individualized culpability for an aggravator, the courts missed part of the statute is what I would submit. And it should reevaluate the language in Coleman to see whether it has unintentionally glossed over plain language of a statute, which plain language cannot be disregarded given the instructions of the code about interpreting statutes. So I don't know how to reconcile those two, Your Honor. I would acknowledge that.
Do you want to go to your second argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, as far as argument two goes, I'm just address the first three unless the court wants me to move on to the four and five. As far as argument two goes, this trio, the prosecutor wanted to show a trio at trial, Allen, Howard, and McCray. And Howard and McCray had already pled. They were from New Jersey. Allen was a Delawarean who had moved to Delaware and acknowledged that these fellows came to see him at his home in Delaware. He denied this participation in their criminality. So our goal was to show, one of the goals on cross of Howard was to show that he and McCray had been developing this kind of criminal relationship for a number of years in New Jersey, and that Allen was a convenient sort of add-on to their activities, but providing a Delaware kind of base for their activities. So I reprinted the dialogue with the court and with the counsel that occurred during trial in my opening brief. I won't repeat it, but the court's been very clear on cross-examination. Defendant, right of confrontation pursuant to the Sixth Amendment. He's being accused essentially by criminals, Mr. Howard, that he has an opportunity to explore their relationships with other criminals in the case and see how long-standing that criminal relationship is among those parties. That's critical to showing that Howard and McCray are longtime partners in crime, and Allen, by contrast, is not the partner in crime that they've been over the years.
Didn't that evidence come in somehow? Anyway.
There were admissions of Howard's convictions, Your Honor, but I wanted to go beyond that. I sought to go beyond that.
Coming from Howard himself, didn't he admit the association in robbing banks? Or not?
He admitted a past, yes, Your Honor, with McCray.
Well, and didn't Howard characterize McCray as the leader?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is correct. And again, the goal was to show that these were not just three amigos, that these were not three fellows getting together in Delaware. And even though it was risky on my part as Allen's attorney to ask Howard about that past, because Howard, of course, could have included Allen in that past, and that was a risk that I was running, I acknowledge. I might not like the answer I got from Howard. Perhaps Her Honor was thinking about, I'll protect Mr. Haley from the answer he might get from this witness and say, because he might just put the finger on my client for this past also. But I submit that I was allowed to walk out on that wire and explore that with Howard, because I felt Howard would be defensive about it, and anything I could do to make Howard either get defensive in front of that jury, not admit things, begin to divide him trustworthiness-wise from the jury, that would show how deep his association was with McCray, I should have been allowed to do that.
And what was the trial judge's reason for limiting your cross-examination?
My recollection is that impeachment in her mind was adequately developed through his convictions of record, and that being able to explore beyond convictions of record of Mr. Howard, what he had done prior bad acts with Mr. McCray, was not a door she would let me open, essentially.
So your contention is your client's Sixth Amendment right to confrontation was violated because if you could have asked more questions, you would have demonstrated, hopefully, that Howard and McCray were close personal friends involved in criminal activities and that your client was on the fringe.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly.
Now, you asked to reserve 5 minutes. You can continue.
Okay.
But you're into your rebuttal time now.
Your Honor, I'll reserve it this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. Section 274 of the Delaware Code is only applicable to crimes in which the offense is divided into degrees which are separated by mental state. This Court's been very clear on that point in Coleman, in Johnson, in Richardson, including Johnson this year.
How about the distinction between a weapon or no weapon?
To the extent that that's in Section 274, 274 uses the language and, culpable mental state and an aggravating factor. The mental state is a necessary division between those. If you want to show that your client didn't know that there was a weapon involved, that's a proof of fact question that requires a different type of instruction than a 274 instruction. This is simply for offenses where it's divided by culpable mental state. The state can find no case where it's been applied otherwise, including Herring. The issue in Herring was whether, and the issue that the court chose to address in Herring, was that theft was not a, it was not a degree of robbery, and that you didn't automatically get it by the operation of 274, even if it did apply robbery.
So we can look at the language in Herring that said properly instructed as dicta.
To the extent that the instruction in Herring, I've reviewed the briefs, was a little odd, but I believe there was some part of 274 instructed in there, but certainly this Court's holding in Coleman, Johnson, and Richardson was far more clear on the point that it's not applicable to robbery, to burglary, to theft, and in fact was inapplicable to any of Mr. Allen's charges. In fact,
it's all right to characterize the language in Herring as dicta.
It would appear to be. It's just I've reviewed the briefs, and it's unclear what was actually given in Herring. The fact is that there was testimony that Allen knew McCray had a gun, especially given the nature of these robberies. These were overnight robberies in which McCray would lie in wait for someone from the store to come in, at which point he would accost them with a weapon and force them to surrender the cash.
But Mr. Haley's argument is, if we're talking about culpable mental states, if you don't know your co-defendant has a gun because you were unaware of it when they went in to rob the store while you waited outside, then if you could convince the jury of that, they might find you have a different culpable mental state.
Your Honor, the culpable mental state is not – that's a proof of fact question. The culpable mental state is – intentional act. You knew or should have known that there was a weapon involved.
But I thought that 274 talks about offenses separated by degree.
Yes. And that are divided by culpable mental state and another aggravator. The state would suggest that word and here is substantial and probably led to the holding in Coleman, Johnson, and Richardson.
So it's your position today that if the undisputed facts at trial indicate the co-defendant didn't know the other co-defendant had a gun, and the person who demonstrates lack of knowledge of the weapon asks for a 274 instruction, the proper ruling by the trial court would be, you don't get that. Your client agreed to engage in a robbery. Whether they knew there was a gun or not is irrelevant. I'm not giving the 274 instruction.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The 274 instruction is inapplicable, and that's the state's position. And is, in fact, only applicable to cases of homicide and assault.
All right. And let's suppose that the defense attorney says, Your Honor, I accept your ruling under 274. I now want a charge on a lesser included offense because I think that's supported by the evidence that my client had no knowledge of a weapon. How would the trial judge rule?
the judge could give an instruction consistent with that position. To the extent that that is a proof of fact that needs to be proven to elevate the crime from robbery second to robbery first. But that's not a 274 instruction. And, in fact, there was no specific instruction for a lesser on robbery here. The request was made at page A183 when the trial judge asked, well, what lessers do you want? Because it was unclear from Mr. Haley's position whether he wanted it on the robberies or on any other position. He didn't proffer any specific lesser included. And as the state has said, there are no charges that Mr. Allen was facing that a 274 instruction would have been appropriate. Moving on to Mr. Allen's second argument.
What is, tell me the scenario when the state is proceeding in a prosecution for a robbery that person A had the gun and that person B was an accomplice. The accomplice instruction on the weapons offense as to person B, what does that state as to the state of mind of person B?
If I may, just look at the instruction given here. It is a person is guilty of an offense committed by another when intending to promote or facilitate the commission of the offense, the person aids, counsels, or agrees or attempts to aid the other person in planning or committing it. A person may be found guilty as an accomplice for an offense committed by another person if you are unanimously satisfied the person alleged to be the accomplice acted intentionally, that is, intended to promote or facilitate the commission of a crime.
So that would cover in terms of a weapons offense, the possession of a firearm during the commission of the offense.
Certainly. And to the extent that you would be able to find him, the state must still prove a weapon was used in that offense. We don't get around that by merely alleging it. That is still a proof of fact that we have to make at trial, that a weapon was used. Otherwise, no robbery first occurred, and we can't prove that unless we prove a weapon was used in the trial. Here, the testimony of Howard and of Sherry Randolph, who was, I believe, the only witness who was actually accosted, there were some witnesses from Walmart who saw a weapon, was that there was a gun involved. And
just let me make sure. Do I understand the state's position to be that when robbery is the charge and there's accomplice liability alleged, you never get a 274 instruction under any circumstance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but let me flesh this out just a little bit more. Although you wouldn't ever get a 274 instruction because the state says that it's an intentional act, whether you're an accomplice or the principal, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That nonetheless, the state acknowledges that if the principal actor had a gun and that made it robbery one, but the accomplice didn't know that there was going to be a gun, only knew that there was going to be a robbery, that the accomplice could properly ask for, and you would expect the court to give an instruction on the lesser included offense of robbery two as it applies to the accomplice?
Not based on the defendant's lack of knowledge, rather based on the fact that the state must still prove that there was a weapon involved, and that elevate the only distinguishing element between robbery one and robbery two is the presence of a weapon.
Okay, but here's where I'm getting confused. Let's assume that it's been proven that there was a weapon involved, okay? But that it's also been proven that the current defendant was an accomplice but didn't know there was going to be a weapon used. The defendant was sitting outside watching whatever, doing something else, participating in the robbery but did not know that a weapon was going to be involved.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that defendant entitled to a lesser included offense instruction saying that all he committed was robbery two, not robbery one?
Not under Section 274, Your Honor.
So what we're getting at is that as you view it, an accomplice to a first-degree robbery is guilty of first-degree robbery, regardless of what the accomplice knew or didn't know about the existence and use of a weapon in that robbery.
Yes, Your Honor.
And therefore, there would be no lesser-included offense and no accomplice instruction because it's intentional and because you can't get out of being convicted of the first-degree crime just because you didn't know there was a gun.
You may still get the lesser-included offense only if there is if the question of whether there is a weapon is there, then we still need to prove against the accomplice that the original act committed by the primary was robbery first. We still need to prove that that act was committed.
All right. So what you're saying is that participant B, the accomplice, could get a lesser included offense if there was some reason to doubt that participant A had actually used a gun.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if it's clear that participant A had used a gun, then participant B couldn't get a lesser based on the fact that he didn't know there was going to be a gun there.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now I'm clear. Thank you.
All right. Well, and I think I understand it too, but let me give one more example just to be sure. Let's assume two people decide to commit a robbery, and they decide to commit the robbery without a weapon. And one of them stays outside and one goes in. And the establishment where the robbery is going to occur is a sporting goods store that sells guns. So notwithstanding the plan to commit a robbery without a gun, once the person's inside committing the robbery, they seize a gun and they complete the robbery by using a gun that's undisputed. As I understand your answer to all of our questions, you're saying that the person who stood outside could testify that wasn't the plan, I didn't know there was going to be a gun, and the judge would properly say, that's unfortunate, but you don't get an instruction under 274, and you don't get a charge on a lesser included offense because, in fact, it's undisputed the robbery was accomplished with a gun. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, isn't there another statute that deals with unforeseen results?
I'm unsure, Your Honor, and that may be coloring my answer, but I'm not positive on it. I forgive my ignorance of the law on this point. Moving on now to argument two. What Mr. Allen sought to do, and I must admit that I'm still a bit foggy on the point, was to delve into specific criminal conduct that had never been convicted. He had access to Mr. Howard's prior criminal history. This included the criminal charges that had been resolved in both Delaware and in New Jersey federal court. He cross-examined him on that. Allen cross-examined Howard on the terms of his plea agreement and the nature of the incentive that he had to testify. Howard admitted that he was friends with Kevin McRae, admitted that he had committed robberies with Kevin McRae, admitted that he had known him longer, I believe, than he had Mr. Allen. What Mr. Allen sought to do was to go into something that is prohibited by Rule 608B, which is uncharged conduct, that there was no proffer as to what he wanted to get at other than the depth of their criminal relationship, whatever that meant. The proffer at the, when the trial judge asked him, what do you intend to get at? Give me some specifics. Mr. Haley could proffer nothing as to what he was going at with this. Under Wright, the trial judge is not required to allow unfettered cross-examination on the mere chance that there may be bias. And this court laid out the standard on curtailing a cross-examination under Weber. Whether the witness is crucial, and there's no question here that Isaiah Howard was crucial. whether there is a logical relevance to the question of bias. And the state would suggest there's no logical relevance here. Nothing that Isaiah Howard could have said would have benefited Kevin McCray or himself in any way, aside from ensuring that his plea deal followed through successfully. Kevin McCray was
already... Well, as I understand Mr. Haley's argument, he was going to try to portray Howard and McCray, even though they were both men, but basically as Bonnie and Clyde, and that Alan was a person who happened to meet them by chance, and they didn't have a long or lasting relationship, and that Bonnie and Clyde, you know, had this long history together, and now they were going to implicate Alan because that would help them in their plea agreements with the state, and that he didn't get to cross-examine and develop the, quote, Bonnie and Clyde history.
Well, he didn't get to go into uncharged criminal conduct for which there was no proof. That was the concern for the trial court. It was, what are you talking about when you talk about this relationship?
So getting to the constitutional line, you're saying the trial judge concluded there was no factual basis for the proffered cross-examination, and in the absence of a factual basis, the court was not going to allow it.
Yes. Based on Mr. Allen's representations at trial, there was no basis to go beyond what was already there, and which was fully proper under 609.
I just want to interrupt this point, because no one talked about the habitual offender status, and I realize the state has a motion to strike,
yes,
which will put aside for purposes of the court's questions. It appears that in some prior cases, our court said you should have a separate hearing on your status as a habitual offender, followed by your sentencing. And it looks like in this case, that did not occur. Is that correct?
After the second trial, that is correct, Your Honor. After the first trial, he had a habitual offender hearing. And before the same judge, after the second trial, it was combined into a single hearing.
And that's after the appeal to this court, and it went back?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, explain why he wasn't in, if he got a new trial, why wasn't he entitled to another habitual offender hearing?
Well, first, Your Honor, the state must suggest that there was no objection to the combining of these two events. There was an inordinate amount of papers filed beforehand. As I noted in my brief, the state's habitual offender motion was 150 pages plus long.
Well, the way I read the record, and I'm simply interrupting you because we only have 2 minutes left and I want to ask the questions that are unanswered in my mind. As I understand it, they got to the combined hearing. Mr. Allen said through his attorney, I'd like to be heard. The judge said, I've read everything. You're not going to do that. Now, related to the state's pending motion to strike, we have a suggestion that a couple of the offenses that were counted for habitual offender status occurred simultaneously, and maybe they shouldn't have been counted. And the argument I know that's in contention is, if you would have listened to us and given us a hearing, we would have told you, you can't count these separately. Is that correct?
That is wrong. And what the state would suggest is it was Mr. Allen was given an inordinate amount of time to respond to these things in writing. He was saying that there were errors in the habitual offender motion. The habitual offender motion is very dense. It doesn't lend itself to an in-court airing of grievances. Was given two opportunities to respond to the state's was given an opportunity first to amend their objections by the court, an opportunity which he declined or neglected to take advantage of. The state filed an amended motion with a tremendous amount more documentation on each of these charges. Again, given an opportunity.
Did a certified docket entries showing his convictions on habitual offender eligible crimes?
I believe that's all in the motion. It may have not been in the original motion, but it was certainly in the amended motion. This was the habitual triggering offense, and I believe that it's certified in all of the documents in there. At least that's what I've been told by the – all I have are copies. I don't know if they were the original copies.
Other than in this case, either before the reversal or after this trial, was there any other determination that the defendant was an habitual offender in any prior Superior Court proceeding?
No, Your Honor. And the state would suggest that the failure to present his specific objections in the brief on appeal should represent a waiver of this claim.
Well, before you sit down, is it the state's position that this offense that he was convicted for after the new trial was the triggering offense for habitual offender status?
Yes, Your Honor.
And even though we've said you need a separate hearing, in this case, there was no need for a separate hearing because there had been a prior hearing.
No, that would not be – that's – part of it is certainly that. There's also the fact that there had been a tremendous amount before this.
No, I understand that part. Where I don't understand that is if our court says you need a separate hearing, I don't know of any case that says, well, if you have a lot of information and a lot of papers on the record, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's mandate that you have a separate hearing, since we have a lot of paper here, we don't need to have a hearing. That's not what you're saying, is it?
No, Your Honor. Certainly this court has said before you should have a separate hearing. They've also said that barring an objection, you must show prejudice from the fact that the hearings were combined. There was no objection to the combined hearing. Mr. Allen was aware prior to the hearing that everything would be decided based on the briefs and did not object there to having no separate hearing.
Why did he ask to be heard if he knew all of this was going to happen on the papers?
Mr. Haley would have to speak to that. The court's instruction was very clear. Everything must be on the papers. And here he can show no prejudice from the combining of the hearings.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Can you talk about these habitual offender status questions that we've been asking?
Do I need to, Your Honor?
No, I'd like you to.
You'd like me to? Okay. Your Honor, there were objections of record. They were made in opposition to the state's original motion. The lower court directed the state to supplement or refile or expand upon its motion, which the state did September, October of the year of the sentencing. We received the state's papers, it was Allen's preference to respond to those things at the hearing. He insisted upon that. In fact, he wrote, it was so important to him, he wrote the court himself a letter, directly to the court, not through counsel, insisting upon that. And that was the chosen plan for Allen to respond to the state's a thicket of material the state had submitted. And that was the anticipation that I had going to the courtroom. I said, good morning to Your Honor. And Her Honor, frankly, I think anticipated Mr. Allen wanted to speak or address it orally too because she had gotten his letter and instead decided I've announced, not a combined hearing, but announced her decision, you're a habitual offender, let's proceed to sentencing. So there was no hearing. If hearing means, some kind of dialogue or oral argument, there was none. It was not combined. It was
inquiry of the defendant, do you accept or oppose the petition and do you agree that you have this conviction, and that conviction?
Right, and there were no announced findings of what the court was relying upon as predicates for the status. That is, I find this conviction, add up to four, and you're going to be a habitual offender based on the convictions of this date, and today, and most recently. So what the court relied upon to arrive at that habitual status, there's no record of that.
Now, the defendant's objection was that he was misidentified, he was not convicted. What was the basis for his objection?
His contentions were, in essence, that the records were ambiguous and that New Jersey offenses did not, that maybe were felonies when they were charged, but resulted in lesser included offense pleas, did not match up with parallel offenses in Delaware as predicate felonies for habitual offender status.
So that was a legal issue?
That was a legal issue. And then more recently, as I alluded to, I know it's subject to being stricken in my reply brief, there are other things that he mentioned, which
in my response. In the judge's response that you referred to, it's on page 21 of your brief, the judge says that the judge had an opportunity to review the response that was filed by Mr. or on Mr. Allen's behalf. Is what you just told us what we would find in that response, that the felonies in New Jersey didn't constitute felonies in Delaware?
Yes, Your Honor. The response she was referring to would have been my original response to the state's motion. I think it was in the summer of and was not directly responsive to the state's supplemental motions or papers that filed in the fall. So am I confused, Your Honor?
No. I guess my question is, I assume you had something additional you wanted to say to the judge at a hearing.
Yes.
Notwithstanding the fact that you had had an opportunity to respond in writing.
Yes, Your Honor. And it was defendant's conscious choice not to communicate in writing, frankly, and to do that orally in court. He thought that would be more effective, and that was the approach he insisted upon.
Well, now I'm confused. What would he have said?
Beyond perhaps expanding on some of the minutia, Your Honor, in these records, I can't tell Your Honor in detail beyond what I've referred to as some things not appearing to match up per the records with Delaware predicate felonies for habitual offender status.
But that was before the court in the paperwork.
It had been as best I could put forward to the court in the summer, yes, Your Honor. And that's what I anticipated.
So in essence, he wanted to have oral argument on what had already been submitted in paper.
Yes, Your Honor, but I can't rule out the fact that he also wanted to speak and might have wanted to say his own things, to be honest, Your Honor.
Okay, but we don't know what those own things would have been and
there's
whether
no record
it
of that
would
yet.
Have added any factual basis to his position as opposed to perhaps a plea for leniency or something like that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, the last question, since you're familiar with this, were you his attorney at the first habitual offender hearing?
No, Mr. Figliola was appointed at the first trial and did that through the penalty.
So irrespective of whether there was a hearing, in this case, we don't have any recitation by the judge that says, I look at the following offenses, 1, 2, 3, and I add to that this conviction, and based on those offenses that I've identified, I declare you to be a habitual offender.
No such finding made of record orally or in writing anywhere, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, on the petition, was there a form of order attached to the petition that the state filed?
I'm sure there was. As far as it being more than a general statement, Your Honor, I can't say what the details were in that. I can try to find the order, I guess, Your Honor.
That's right. Thank you.
Do you know off the top of your head, Mr. Wakely?
I'm looking at it right now, Your Honor.
Well, we can find it if it's in the record. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and adjourn.